This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Eric Wilson is an English professor at Wake Forest University. He's interested in romance literature, and he likes to contemplate ideas of the sublime and transcendence. But that wasn't always the case. He grew up in the small North Carolina town of Taylorsville. Residents lived and breathed football. Dad was a high school football coach who groomed his son to become a star quarterback, and that's exactly what Eric wanted. Play some college football and then go pro. Things were looking good, too. Graduated, was recruited to play at West Point. When he got there, he froze. He realized that if he continued on his path, he'd have to live according to values that he didn't accept. He left West Point, headed back to North Carolina, ended up at Wake Forest University, where he's become a distinguished professor with numerous books to his name. His most recent is called Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck, Why We Can't Look Away. And Eric Wilson joins us now in the studio. Good to have you back. How are you doing?
Thanks, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
I want to talk to you about how you came to be a professor of literature, a career choice that I guess seemed preposterous to you in high school. So we'll sort of get that journey. But I want to talk to you about this latest book, Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck. It's about how we humans can't resist watching disaster unfold and then revisiting it over and over again. And I guess you felt our fascination with 9/11 was one of the catalysts for this book. Is that right?
Yes. One of the reasons I wrote the book was in an attempt to understand my own experience of the news footage of those 9/11 attacks on that horrific day. My wife was 4 months pregnant with our daughter. The news broke early that morning. I watched those attacks over and over again that morning, went to work, turned on my computer, continued to watch. Couldn't stop. Finally got home that night. My wife was preparing dinner and said, please stop watching. Stop looking at that. And I could not. I could not stop looking. And by the end of the day, I had this very complicated mixture of feelings. On the one hand, I still felt that deep unease, that terror. Of course, there was great sorrow for the tragedy. There was guilt that I could not stop watching that footage. I felt that I should not. And then, strangest of all, after watching that footage over and over and over again, it had almost become devoid of meaning and just a very shimmering, bright image, the autumnal blue sky and the billows of smoke. It had taken on a weird sublimity. So I really wanted to understand why I could not stop and why many could not stop, and all the other various forms of morbid curiosity, ranging from rubbernecking to watching violent storms to watching MMA. The list goes on and on and on.
So what do you think is behind it?
Well, I found out that there are several reasons, ranging from, I guess, the most basic animalistic to some of the higher imaginative functions of the human mind. Scientists have shown that when we see violence, be it fictional or nonfictional, our heart rate goes up, our body releases chemicals, we get a rush, we get a thrill, much like we do when we ride a roller coaster at an amusement park. We all feel that, whether we want to admit it or not. But there are psychological reasons as well. Carl Jung, in particular, the Swiss psychiatrist, says that each of us has within our psyche a part that sort of harbors everything that we hate and fear about ourselves. He calls this the shadow side. We repress this. We don't want to face this, right? But the shadow must be fed. And it's precisely that shadow side which draws us to death and destruction and decay.
Have you given some thought to, and does the research show anything about the potential adaptive qualities to this? If we get this rush, if there is this side that we suppress and yet need to feed, what good would that do from an evolutionary standpoint if there's a connection?
Well, this is still a controversial theory. The evidence isn't in, but some scientists have speculated that animals might indeed practice morbid curiosity for evolutionary reasons. For instance, elephants, when one of their herd dies, we'll hang around the corpse for days and we'll poke around the decay and sometimes lift up the bones with their trunks and carry them around. There are stories of gazelles standing close by while a lion eats one of their own herd. Some scientists wonder if in looking at disaster, we ourselves are trying to learn what not to do, what to do to avoid those disasters. Again, the proof isn't in, but it is interesting to think that we're all kind of wired to be drawn to violence, not just for sick thrills, not just for titillation, though that element can be there. There may be values to morbid curiosity that are worth exploring.
Well, and that titillation may be part of that wiring that gets us attracted, gets us back to see what we should avoid. And how much do you think it might be preparation? We're going to talk more about your days as a high school athlete, but as a particularly somebody involved in a violent sport, imagining the collision over and over in some ways prepares us for the inevitable attack or the pain of the collision?
Well, I think this goes beyond the evolutionary, and this takes us to another psychological level, that I think that we are often drawn to disaster really to kind of learn about the tragic nature of existence. Existence is painful. Often in our culture, we can pat ourselves from that. But I think there's a part of us that has a hunger for reality. In fact, some of the more extreme violent websites market themselves with, can you handle the truth? Can you handle reality? I think those sites go a bit too far. But I think ultimately morbid curiosity at its highest level is an effort to try to understand the nature of suffering and the nature of death. And this takes us to the realm of aesthetic morbid curiosity, aesthetic macabre. If we think of, say, Shakespeare's King Lear or Shakespeare's Hamlet, gore, death, destruction, horror, but yet not simply for the sake of sick titillation, really asking us to empathize with the suffering of another. So in some cases, morbid curiosity can be an invitation to empathize. And that requires a great act of imagination to try to figure out what is it like to be that person suffering.
Which brings us to the passion play that you saw and had a great effect on you as well.
Yes, indeed. I couldn't bring myself to watch Mel Gibson's The Passion, that extreme violence, a kind of torture porn, some people call it, just didn't appeal to me. But I thought to research this book, I needed actually to go to a passion play. And there are a lot of fairly violent passion plays growing out of the popularity of Mel Gibson's The Passion. So I went to one of these passion plays down in Charleston, South Carolina. And I thought I would just be laughing at it. In fact, I thought the acting would be bad. I thought there would be a lot of bad Christian rock, a lot of kind of treacly Amy Grant music, and all of those things were there. However, when I saw the scourging of the character who played Jesus, and when I actually saw the crucifixion extremely violently portrayed, the laughing stopped. And I really kind of got a sense of the suffering of Jesus in this particular instance. And I was moved. I mean, I really sort of opened up and I opened out and I tried to think about the nature of suffering, suffering in religion, sacrifice in religion. Now, I'm not a practicing Christian, but certainly I felt the real power of that religion in that very moment.
It shows you, doesn't it? And I guess it illustrates how difficult it is to get it right. If the message of the cross is about empathizing with suffering and embracing your own mortality, how many ways has that message gone wrong in the teaching of this practice, this spirituality over the past 2,000 years? And it actually encourages us to hold pain and suffering at a distance in many ways.
Well, when I was researching a book I wrote a while back called Against Happiness, I was really quite interested to see how many evangelical ministers treat melancholy. Billy Graham, for example, on his website, a person had written in, you know, I've been depressed lately, what should I do? And he suggested, well, you need to pray more. If you're unhappy, that borders on sinfulness, because if you have a true relationship with God, you should be happy all the time. And I really think in America in particular, there's this sense that the Protestant religion can be a kind of constant happy pill. Forgetting that, of course, Jesus, the night before his crucifixion, sweat blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. And right at the moment before he gave up the ghost, says, Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus, in some ways, is the quintessential man of sorrows, whose melancholy is inseparable from his spiritual power.
And it was the centurion who looks at a bloody corpse, looking very dead on that cross, who says, truly he was the Son of God.
Yes.
His death and suffering. And you push that away and you may not embrace your own divinity. So you've thought deeply about all of these things. You even get into some of the more macabre manifestations. I mean, there's the story of Haddon Clark, and you can tell us that this is somebody who went to prison for very serious crimes, and yet people were buying relics by this murderer.
It's a very disturbing phenomenon known as murderabilia, the sale of murderabilia. Heinous criminals, serial killers, monstrous murderers such as Haddon Clark, John Wayne Gacy, and Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer before he died, were able to sell very bad artworks they'd created in prison, or in some cases, fingernail clippings, hair clippings, bars of soap. And people would buy these and still do buy these at a very high rate. You can go on the internet this very day and buy some of this stuff if you want to. It's a kind of perverse version of the medieval saint's relic. You know, there is a sense that these people are sacred in a way. Sacer, Latin, means both accursed and sacred. So there's a sense that these men are somehow beyond the law and they're evil, and that draws certain people to them. And to have a little bit of them is kind of a bit of their destructive power. I actually went to Louisiana and met a person who used to deal in murderabilia. He quit when the criminal John Wayne Gacy, who had murdered many young boys, actually drew a picture of his own son. And at that point, he realized that this is a terrible disservice to the victims. For me to make money on those who have committed these crimes is basically saying to the victims, this pain is not worth considering. So there are certain forms of morbid curiosity that I say go too far if they dehumanize others, if they simply exploit others, commodify others for selfish, sick titillation.
But they might be linked to something in us that longs for the sacred and that wants to get in touch with and communicate with this side of us that we're trying to push away.
And this is exactly where the imagination comes in. If in witnessing someone else's suffering, I'm unable to imagine what it's like for that person to suffer, I distance myself, I reduce that person, I dehumanize that person. But if I see that suffering as a sight for me meditating on my own mortality, meditating on the nature of good and evil, in other words, if I use my morbid curiosity as a sight for meaning, as opposed to simple animal pleasure, at that point, morbid curiosity becomes, again, a kind of higher function of the human psyche, a way for us to realize that only when we know death and destruction can we know what life and joy really are.
Eric Wilson is my guest this hour on The State of Things, English professor at Wake Forest University, author of Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck, Why We Can't Look Away. He's written that and many other books, and we'll find out why that was such an unlikely choice for a young high school athlete who had such a promising athletic career. Find out more on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Eric Wilson, an English professor at Wake Forest University. His latest book is Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck, Why We Can't Look Away. So for somebody interested in intellectual and deeply spiritual, the sublime, Eric, you grew up in a small town, Taylorsville, where football was king, and you were about to be coronated.
Football was my life growing up. My dad was the local high school football coach, very successful. In fact, my high school stadium was just named after him last year, a great honor. So I lived football, I breathed football, I loved it. And I wanted to be a great quarterback, I wanted to play college football and go into the pros. That doesn't mean that I neglected my schoolwork. I read a good bit and I was interested in writing, but I did pretty well in football and I did garner some interest from the service academies, and I was recruited to play football at West Point, and I went there. And within 5 minutes, I knew I wanted to leave. I knew I had to stay 30 days. Everyone does. Otherwise, most would probably leave after 5 minutes. It's very difficult. So that was a very transformative moment for me when a lot of the values with which I'd been brought up were suddenly writ large. Aggression, kind of an overzealous patriotism, an almost blind commitment to authority. And I saw this writ large mixed in with the violence necessary for military. And I said, this is not what I want. So suddenly it's as if everything was sort of stripped away. And then I thought, what now?
But you can really, in the first 5 minutes, because in some ways what you're saying is this simply reinforced a lifestyle that had gotten you where you were, mm-hmm. and that you hadn't challenged, and in fact you had embraced it all this time. What do you think it was about that first 5 minutes that allowed you to see in a new way?
Well, what I realized looking back now, as in junior high and high school, I lived a kind of double life, and I wasn't special in this. A lot of young people have interior lives that are much different from their exterior lives, but I started thinking, I was always interested in comic books and horror films and literature such as J.D. Salinger or the lyrics of John Lennon, but I never took that side seriously. And suddenly, it's as if that side of me was awakened. It was called forth. It was a true epiphany. It was my sort of road to Damascus in a way, and it's the only time that's really happened in my life. And a deeply visceral feeling: this is wrong, this is right. So I had 30 days to get through. And interestingly, the only book that I brought with me, it had Bill Murray on the cover, Bill Murray the comedian. It's not because I was really interested so much in the book. But my mom saw it had Bill Murray on the cover, and you know, I like Bill Murray. This is not Art House, Jim Jarmusch Bill Murray. This is early Bill Murray of Stripes, Meatballs, Saturday Night Live. So she thought, this will cheer my son up, right? So I have the book. Can't sleep at night, very anxious. I've made a decision that will really sort of rock my world. So I start reading this book, and it turns out it's The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham. Bill Murray had played in his first serious film, where he plays Larry Darrell, protagonist of this book. And this book is about a young man traumatized by his experience in World War I, comes back to Chicago, doesn't feel comfortable with the status quo, rejects a good job, rejects a beautiful socialite fiancé, and goes on a lifelong quest for enlightenment. So I'm reading this, and in a way, this book is mirroring what I want to do. And that was a true turning point for me. It really opened me up to the life of the mind, the life of art, the life of literature, which indeed I have stayed true to until this very day.
What did you think about that coincidence? Did you see it as some kind of you know, the inbreaking of the sacred, some divine intervention? How did you take that?
Well, Carl Jung has this idea called synchronicity, which suggests that really strong psychological energies sometimes call forth appropriate physical energies to manifest them. This sounds a little spooky, but yet I think there are those moments of coincidence when what we most need reveals itself. And if we're open to that, we take that. Oftentimes we're not looking, right? And that was one of those very fortunate moments where inside and outside meshed beautifully. And it was a sacred moment where something really powerful and transformative broke into the ordinary and broke what was within me, but opened up, you know, like the shell of a seed, something new.
Before you started reading that book and felt, I guess, somehow affirmed in this decision, were you scared at that decision that I can't be here? Were you adrift? Did you say, well what am I going to do? And how am I going to leave this place? And what are people going to say about me? All those questions you might have had.
I was extremely scared. I knew I'd be disappointing my father. I knew I'd be disappointing my community. In some ways, I was disappointing myself. And yes, I was adrift. What would I now do? It was a fresh start in a way. And in fact, I realize now that was the first moment in my life where I really kind of had a brush with depression, a depression that wasn't debilitating, a depression that sort of pushed me within to find within myself powers that I didn't know I had before. Luckily, I was able to come back and go to a place, to college, Appalachian State, in the mountains, in the gorgeous Blue Ridge Mountains. And this was a perfect place for me to come and really kind of have a wonderful pastoral existence. And I could read Blake, I could read Wordsworth, and they constantly reinforced my decision, and I never really regretted it.
Before you went to Ab State, you went to NC State, and that was another place where you realized, oh no, I can't do this either.
I did. I came back from West Point in mid-August, and the only university I think that would still let me in at that time was NC State. I'd applied to several earlier. And yes, that wasn't really for me either. I was going to study science there. I thought I was going to go pre-med, very technical school, and I just wanted to be at a liberal arts school, and I always loved Boone growing up. I grew up an hour from there, and it was always a special place where I felt like I was closer to reality. So that's what I did, and it was sort of my Thoreauvian 3-4 years.
What is your dad and the folks back home making of all this? Suddenly this football player, this kid who we had some ideas about, he wants to go off into the mountains and read who? Blake?
Well, my dad was wonderful. He could have easily expressed deep anger and just renounced me once and for all. It did hurt him. He disappointed him to some extent, but he showed his true affection for me. He said, I want you to follow your own inner journey. And if it's not football, it's not football. And I will support you in any way. And he sure did. So I really admire him. And I hope that I can be a parent like that if my own daughter doesn't do quite what I want her to do. And I'm sure that will be the case.
Now, it's at this time, and you talked about it a second ago, where you first noticed depression at West Point, and later you begin to realize that you might be on the spectrum of bipolar disorder.
Yes. This really came to light in the years before and during and after my daughter's birth. Throughout college, I constantly moved between extreme depression, which would manifest itself as deep apathy, indifference, a feeling that nothing meant anything, why do one thing or another, almost like channel surfing, hundreds of channels. You've seen all the shows before, but you can't stop surfing. It's just one thing after another. But there was a feeling in me that wanted to make my life meaningful. No, life has to have some purpose. Life has to have some meaning. So I set for myself these, you know, extremely ambitious goals academically. I turned from playing football to doing triathlons, even athletically. So I would sleep little. I would train a lot. I would study a lot. So there was this sort of endless vacillation between these two poles. I frankly thought that anyone who lived the intellectual life felt this way. Well, turned out later that that's not the case. And I was able to sort of deal with my bipolar for many years by being ambitious, thinking if I'm academically successful, clearly I'm mentally healthy. So I was able to channel my mania, as it were, into academic success. But when my daughter was born, suddenly I couldn't work as much on my books and research. And that sort of a little bastion of safety I'd built fell asunder, fell away. And I was left to face myself for the first time and realize, yes, something is deeply wrong. I started feeling suicidal. I was having a difficult time connecting with my daughter, connecting with my wife. The suicidal tendencies increased. And at that point, I finally sought serious psychotherapy.
And you worked on that. How was that period for you in terms of your relationship with your family and your work? What effect did it have initially when you first go into therapy?
Well, what I realized is that I'd been using my bipolar disorder as an excuse not to be present. Now, I'm not saying that everyone depressed does this. I was using my depression. So my wife would rightfully say, can't you be a more engaged parent? Can't you be a more engaged husband? And I would say, can't you see I have bipolar disorder? Can't you see I'm sick? I can't do this. So I had this weirdly perverse relationship to the disease. Yes, I felt that it was a kind of tyrant controlling me, but yet I enjoyed the perverse pleasure of victimhood. It's not my fault. Right. So what I realized, especially in group therapy, in one particular moment, a young woman whose father had treated her very poorly, when she heard me tell my story about my own distancing from my daughter, she said, every minute you're not there for your daughter, you're slowly killing her soul. And I guess after the West Point moment, it was the second such moment that just kind of shocked me into a new reality. So at that moment, I tried very hard to move beyond simply blaming my depression for everything, to take responsibility. And here's what I learned. I learned this from William Blake, that most of the time we go through life trying to make it mean what we want it to mean. Sometimes, though, we can actually see something for what it really is and let it show up for what it really is. And only then can we connect to it properly. Blake calls this forgiveness, strangely, seeing something without judgment. So in a way, I forgave my disease. And that allowed me to see it not as some kind of tyrant ruining my life, but as a part of me, like my heart, my lungs, my knee, a part of me that was integral to who I am. And at that point, I was able to sort of take responsibility to interpret the disease in ways that were more beneficial, that would allow me to connect more closely with my daughter and my wife.
Before this, I wonder what your relationship was to the authors that you taught and studied, particularly somebody like Blake, who seems manic. It is certainly mostly manic, but I guess you could imagine him bipolar. Was there a certain romance for you about, well, this is the life of the artist. This is, we can't be normal. We're artists.
That is exactly right. And that's part and parcel of me sort of using my depression as a way to distance myself from what I should have been doing. Yes, of course I'm depressed. I'm because I have deeper insight into the world. The world's a terrible place. I think about it a lot. I'm like Blake. I'm like Melville. I'm like Coleridge. Not realizing all along that these men who were deeply depressed were able to transform their depression into capacious, generous visions that enrich the world, as opposed to kind of pulling within and being uncreative, which is exactly what I was doing.
It's like these writers who sit at the bar and say, well, I'm imitating Fitzgerald.
That's right. That's
okay,
right.
But you haven't written the book yet. So you've only got half of it right.
Yes.
So you do have this insight. Were you worried at any point that if I treat this thing, a lot of the energy that I've brought to my scholarship to date might be lost? It might end it all.
I was extremely afraid of that. And that is why I put off taking antidepressants for a very long time. You know, it's a really difficult question. Some might say, well, if Melville had had his depression treated, would he have written Moby Dick? Maybe not. But then you might say, if he had had his depression treated, might he have written another Moby Dick and had a more satisfying life with his wife and his sons? it took me a while to make this transition. I tried lots of different medications before I found some that actually worked. And what I realized is if one does find medications that work, and I know many people aren't fortunate enough to find medications that work, then it's almost as if depression was like very loud static in my mind. It clouded my mind, kept me from thinking clearly. Often that lack of clarity manifested in mania. The medication turned that static down just a little bit to where I could start hearing my thoughts more clearly. So in some ways, I think that the medications now make me a better writer because I hope a more humane person.
What have they done for you, or what is this whole experience? How has it changed, if it has, your teaching and your understanding of these writers and in the way you teach them to your students?
I think before, as much as I love, say, a Blake or a Coleridge, I was in a way using them as commodities to further my academic success. Oh, I'm going to read Blake. Can I turn that into an article? Can I turn that into a book? But after these insights I had, struggling through the depression, I saw them as true soul doctors, spiritual guides, as it were, who, through their own struggle with depression and transformation of the darkness into light, became a model for me. And also, I hope, a model for my students. Many college students are suffering from real depression. Those that aren't suffering from clinical depression are in, you know, very anxious situations, lots of transformations going on. So I think I became a much more embodied teacher, less theoretical, more willing to talk about my own relationship to the literature instead of just talking about it theoretically, and more willing to try to bring students in to talk about how the literature related to their own existential situations.
And that seems to relate to your insight that it was the way they coped with this disorder. In fact, their art was moving through and coming into relationship with it rather than just be sort of the byproduct.
Yes.
Right? And seeing it that way. So who for you embodies this this idea of polarity and unity, the integration of these two spirits?
Well, I think many of my poetic heroes are interested in polarity, or have a sense that we are broken, we are torn asunder. You can call it the fall, you can call it all sorts of things, and are trying to bring oppositions into relationship. For me, the most powerful visionary of polarity, of melancholy and joy, is John Keats. John Keats, in his great poem, Ode on Melancholy, says that we only find the world beautiful when we know that the world is dying. For this reason, a real rose, say, is much more beautiful than a porcelain rose. We see that real rose, it's tender, it's fragile. We know that, you know, the wind is blowing through it, it will die soon. And that makes us want to enjoy that beautiful moment all the more intensely. For Keats, this is the relationship between melancholy. I know the world's a tragic place. I know things are passing. The world is a place of loss, death, decay, suffering. But only when I embrace that fully does the world become luminous with beauty, and I want to say to it, stay.
All right. You just got back from Europe. You were in London teaching for a while. What did you learn there?
Well, I learned that yes, reading books is wonderful for the imagination, but also not reading books and going out into the world with a real hunger for immediate experience is also a very important part of education. I sort of knew this in the abstract, but I learned it very concretely, taking students to the house Keats lived in Hempstead, where upon being ill with tuberculosis, he would often be led down to a green divan in front of a window looking at a mulberry tree and there feel the comfort of nature and write some of his greatest poetry. For me to see that, for the students to see that, made that poetry come alive in a way that it would not have had we not been there. And also it encouraged students to think about the poetry as a sort of salve for their own souls and then hopefully to think about their own writing. Doing for them what Keats' writing did for him. So it became a really wonderful opportunity to talk about the kind of conversation between authority and experience, you know, book and fact, as it were, that one side always nourishes the other in an ideal educational situation.
And that is the kind of heaven and hell of reading, isn't it? It allows us these other experiences. It opens the imagination, but the danger is that you don't get out of your cell and live the whole world that way.
Well, Emerson famously said in American Scholar that books are for a scholar's idle times, meaning that if you're out in nature really living life, don't spend your time reading. Walt Whitman says, "My best student is he who destroys the teacher." So there's a sense that if you spend too much time reading the thoughts of someone else, you're going to experience the world through that person's eyes and not through your own. But that's not to say that certain books can't open us up to experience the world in a new way. I read Whitman's Leaves of Grass. I never see grass the same way again. It opens up a kind of possibility for me to live that was not there before.
How has it changed your thoughts on teaching, and sort of what are the innovations that you have brought or would like to bring to teaching to bring these two ideas together, to open up but to embody what it is you've learned?
Well, I've become a much more collaborative teacher. I'm much more interested in getting input from students, even at the beginning of class. What are you interested in? What thoughts are you struggling with? And using that as a kind of an agenda for what text we'll read throughout the course. I'm more interested in group projects. I'm more interested in collaborative projects. I no longer want to stand up front and say, I'm the source of knowledge. I want to be more like Socrates, as it were, the midwife. I want to try to help students coax out what is within them as best I can. So I think that it's made me a teacher who values process much more than product. And knowledge not so much as memory and memorization, but knowledge as thoughtful presentness to what is in front of you.
It seems to me that's got to be hard to do. You're an expert in Keats. You're an expert in Blake. You've got a whole program planned. We can get through this if we just follow along. And then they say, well, you know, actually, we'd rather read, you know, something else. Can you make those adjustments? And have you found it's easier now to adjust to what these students say?
It's always a challenge because certainly there are certain ideas that I think are important. I can't step aside entirely. And also, frankly, I'm probably like most teachers, I'm a bit of an egomaniac. I like standing up, showing off about what I know. So it's a constant calibration of, okay, these are things that I think are important, and they are, but these are things you think are important, and I want to value them. I think it's just being open and willing to revise, sometimes every class, sometimes revise the syllabus as we go along. Open to the present, but also with the sense that there are certain structures in place that we need to embody as best we can.
Talking to Eric Wilson today, English professor at Wake Forest University. His latest book, Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck, Why We Can't Look Away. Just ahead, we'll talk more with Eric Wilson on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Eric Wilson, an English professor at Wake Forest University, author of several books, the latest, Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck, Why We Can't Look Away. Talking about this question of integration and how we have built an entire social order on the avoidance of pain, and sort of what that means for us. And I wonder if you see this as a kind of social evolution. In other words, are things really getting worse for humans as we sort of become more and more divorced from the natural world and the suffering within it? Or has it always been this?
Well, I think now, because of our technological advances, there are more opportunities to live virtually. As opposed to actually. And this can range from eating artificial food to plastic surgery to gated communities to spending hour after hour on the internet. So I think certainly there has always been a fear of the real. And what I mean by that is a desire to escape the pain of time. Existence is painful. We suffer, we die. And certainly there's an impulse to want to live a life sheltered from that suffering. The risk becomes when we sort of shelter ourselves to the point where we cut ourselves off from the darker, more painful sides of life, forgetting that we can't know pleasure without pain. We can't know light without darkness. So I would say that that impulse to try to shelter ourselves from the real, it's easier to do that now. And probably there's not a difference in degree in kind. We've always had that, but a difference in degree. And in my book, Against Happiness, I really explore the danger of that, the danger of America in particular, overemphasizing happiness at the expense of sadness. It's like wanting all up with no down, all light with no darkness. First of all, it doesn't work. And second of all, it leads to a rather attenuated half existence.
The danger for the individual is just that, a kind of death of the soul for the individual. But then if you build a whole social order on that and find that a privileged few have sort of jiggered the rules, it gets really dangerous, doesn't it, for an entire society to build itself on that premise, particularly when only very few seem to be able to escape even momentarily.
Well, this is one of the problems of capitalism, if taken in certain directions, that there's a sense that nothing is valuable until it can become quantified and sold, until it can be turned into a commodity. So there's a sense in our world that I can only value something if I can sell it. And I think there's a real desire on the part of many individuals to be paid for every air we, for every breath we take, right? I myself need to become a commodity, and that's how I'll become valued. And our culture sort of values those who are very wealthy, and these people are our heroes. So I think for many, there's a sense that, well, if I'm going to be a hero, this is how I have to be as well.
And so the people who become heroes are the ones who are have most desacralized everything, and transubstantiation becomes turning money into a sports car. If you do that magic enough, it starts to be addicting, doesn't it?
Well, I think in our culture, one problem is we have a whole different idea of what celebrity is from what it, say, used to be in the 19th century, when, and even earlier, the idea that to be a celebrity is someone who is worthy of our admiration. Now someone is a celebrity if he or she gets looked at a lot by the camera. And I think there's been a kind of flattening out. If Donald Trump is in the media a lot, then clearly he is worthy of our admiration. If Charlie Sheen is in the media a lot, he's worthy of our admiration. And I think that sort of cuts down on our ability to make these important distinctions. Some people are worthy of our admiration. And I think these are the people who, again, try to take away the veil of abstraction, of virtuality, of capitalism, and show us the world for what it is. And this can be a value, I think, of, well, it's a romantic idea called the sublime, right? It was a really common distinction made in the 18th century between an experience of the beautiful and an experience of the sublime. An experience of the beautiful is an experience that kind of reinforces what we already believe. It's harmonious, it's comfortable, pure pleasure. Sublime is an experience, say, like of a tornado or a hurricane or just of an idea that blows our mind, that is as painful as it is pleasurable. Where suddenly we feel like the world is just too big for our minds. I can't get an image to capture this great power. I can't find a concept to corral this great power. So those are the moments when we realize that we aren't in control. Those are the moments we realize that there are powers beyond us, and we feel dwarfed and humbled often. But at the same time, if the sublime is working well, we feel expanded. We too are part of these great energies. So I would say that in some ways, an ecological vision, a proper ecological vision, can push against this overemphasis on commodification by showing us their mysterious forces at play that are utterly indifferent to human endeavor. And this can be quite healthy to realize that we are not the whole show.
But are we even losing the sense of that? The fact that we can so easily channel our attention to only the media that affirms and reaffirms what we want, we can shelter ourselves even from those sublime upendings.
Yes, we can. And the news media often does that by filtering disaster and turning it into entertainment, right? But also at the same time, I think there are moments when disaster breaks through and humanizes us. I'm certainly not saying that we should court disaster. No way.
We don't have to.
It occurs. It occurs. Right. There are horrible things that go on in this world. And sometimes those are moments when we do, as a kind of mass of humanity, suddenly are faced with the fact that the world is a dark and scary place and people are suffering mightily. And often it can pull us out of our kind of selfishness and make us feel, at least for a little while, as if we're part of something larger than ourselves. Let me give you an example. I begin my book, Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck, by talking about my experience of watching the 9/11 footage. I end it by talking about an experience I had in the Ground Zero Museum just two summers ago, where I saw all these photographs of the attacks and the aftermath of the attacks. And in one such photograph, it's a cold, misty dawn. All these rescue workers are dirty. They've been digging for remains all night. And there's a priest blessing these workers before they go out and work during the day. And one of the commentators says of the picture that we realize after all these months of dealing with tragedy, darkness, loss, despair, that this place had become holy ground. In other words, to think about the suffering and the death, as horrible as it was, taught us what we should value most in our lives, taught us to think about our loved ones in a different way, taught us to think about the nature of suffering in a different way. This is what the sublime can do. This is what disaster can do. It can shock us out of the familiar in some cases and open us up to suffering in an empathetic way.
And yet our desire to find meaning and to make sense of it, to get our heads around it, quickly politicizes an event like that. So in not very, it doesn't take long to fit all of this into the categories of self and other, those against us, those and our enemy, and what do we do about them? And boy, it's very understandable all of a sudden in a historical way.
Well, I think this is the absolute necessity for artists. I think artists are the ones in society, poets, musicians, painters, who try to hold the mystery of the sublime, who try to hold a place for the ambiguity, who try to hold a place for what is not knowable, in such a way that our imaginations are called forth outside of ourselves. When the artists go away, then yes, everything becomes a soundbite and an ideological argument.
Are we swamping our artists? Are we able to hear them with the same to the same effect, given the amount of noise, given how quickly we turn things into sound bites and very easy tropes to understand what is absolutely ineffable and not understandable?
I think it does become more difficult. As I said, we're in a world where the virtual inundates us, swamps us, overwhelms us. I think that probably the most powerful artists are the ones who know this and accept this and try to work within this. William Blake had this idea that a true artist does not stand on the side and prophesy like John the Baptist. A true artist like Jesus jumps in among the masses and tries within the darkest parts of the culture to create light.
And in a way, embody the story. To what extent is the artist responsible for living the life that they project in their art?
Well, this is a question I struggle with constantly. I don't know of any artist who is worthy of his or her vision in most cases. I would say John Keats probably comes the closest. But I think this is a time when we have to be sort of, we have to sometimes separate the artist from his work. The work is out there. If it's generous, capacious, if it's transformative, if the artist is a real scoundrel, I think we have to be a little bit forgiving in some cases. That's not to say that we should give artists a blank check entirely, but I think it's an unfair expectation for us to assume that artists can be as powerful all the time as the works they create.
It is pretty amazing that the most well-known and influential wordsmith in our language is somebody who we know very little about. We know nothing about Shakespeare, and everything we think we know, somebody else has written the book and said that isn't true.
Well, I tell my students, if we had Shakespeare sitting right beside of us and we asked him, what does Hamlet mean? He would tell us what he thought, but we might find other meanings in Hamlet, and they're there. The language is bigger than Shakespeare is. And
I was going to say, you're about to write a book on Keats. Tell us about that.
Well, I realized being in London that Keats, for someone of my age, 45, with a 10-year-old daughter moving into middle age, I think Keats, of all the people I've read, even though he died at a very young age, has more of a sense of the role of loss in the imaginative life and ultimately the role of loss in building a soul. The book's called How to Make a Soul. It's based on this wonderful letter that Keats wrote where he says, I call the world the veil or the valley of soul making. The idea being that the world, because it is a place of pain and suffering and loss, that's what turns us from just a kind of indifferent monad of consciousness to this person and not another person. In other words, we can only know who we are when we know that only we can die our deaths, only we can die our own deaths. So there's a sense that it's precisely suffering that teaches us who we are as individuals, what we can do as individuals, what we should do as individuals. So it's very much a book on how to make a soul. Soul being living a kind of imaginative life, a life that's honestly embracing what is worst in the world, but constantly trying to transform that into art that can enrich the world.
It's a revolutionary thought all by itself that we're not born with a soul, but that, in fact, the whole project, beginning to end, birth to death, is making that soul.
That's exactly right. And I hope that's what a value this book will have, that will show us that a soul is not some sort of little individual seed that is put in us at birth and that will outlive us after we die. But a soul is a process. It's what it means to be human. We're constantly creating our humanity as we live. We're constantly revising, recalibrating, opening ourselves to the new. And it takes great imagination to negotiate all of that complexity. If we do this with good energy and good intent, then we will create a soul.
Keats brought you and your wife together.
Yes, he did. took a trip with the English department, sponsored by the English department in 1988 throughout Europe. My wife at the time, my current wife, name is Sandy. At the time, she had a boyfriend. I had a girlfriend. So there was not much romantic action going on there. However, we went to the Protestant cemetery just outside of Rome and visited the gravesite of Keats, who died in Rome. And my wife, Sandy, was assigned to give an oral report on Keats. And so here we are in this gorgeous, embowered cemetery, and she sits 2 feet from Keats's grave and gives this beautiful, beautiful oral report on John Keats. She was a nutritionist, so I admired even more her poetic sensibility. So when I saw her 3 years later, when we were both unattached, I immediately remembered, that's the woman who gave the great Keats report. And we fell in love almost immediately, and the rest is history.
It is a great story. Yeah, and you're also working on a book on authenticity and phoniness.
Yes, it's, the tentative title is Keep It Fake, The Art of Being a Real Phony. And it kind of explores ways that we, in America in particular, are addicted to artificiality, even though we think we're being authentic. But also ways that if we're aware that we're being inauthentic, we can turn life into art. So the tricky thesis of the book is this. If we think we're authentic all the time, we're liars because it's impossible to be authentic all the time. If we know we're lying, in some ways we can become authentic.
And in some ways, how could you not be authentic even if you fabricate your memoir? There's something about what you did and the act of creating that that was an authentic act. You wrote a book. And again, getting back to Jung and these ideas of sort of stuff we don't know perking around down there. I mean, is it even sensible to talk about anything as inauthentic, even if it was intentionally deceiving?
Well, if I ask you who you are, you'll probably think, well, this happened, this happened, this happened, and you'll piece together a narrative. Billions of things have happened to you, but you're focusing on maybe 1,000. So our very sense of identity, our very sense of a past, it's a narrative that we create. It's like a novel that we ourselves have written and are writing currently. The goal is to become aware of that process, and then you give yourself the power to sort of even revise your past. If you're in an identity that's not working for you, you can reimagine your life, choose other incidents, perhaps, that were important to you that you hadn't thought about before from your past. And it can really sort of reshape your whole identity. This is living life as art.
You can think of the and see the power in that kind of a process, and also the danger of disintegration. Oh, my God, if I'm not all those things, I'm nothing.
That's right. So with suddenly this openness of creativity becomes tremendous responsibility. We can become divorced from the real. We can imagine an existence that has no relationship to what's going on. This is where I turn to the great line of someone like William James, the American pragmatist, where he says loosely, there is no true idea. Truth happens to certain ideas. So suddenly we can start saying that a construction of identity that feels true, that connects us to the world in rich, fulfilling ways, that's true for that time. As opposed to an idea that does the opposite of those things, we can call that idea false, right? So these ideas I'm going to be exploring are very much about how we create certain ideas that feel true if they connect us more fully to the world, and ideas that do not are false.
Eric, always such a great pleasure talking with you. Keep writing and come back.
Thank you, Frank. I hope to come back.
Eric Wilson, a professor of English at Wake Forest University, author of the book Everyone Loves a Good Train Wreck and Why We Can't Look Away. He's an author of many, many other books as well. You can check out his blog at againsthappiness.blogspot.com. And that's the State of Things for today. You know where to find us, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Sarah Edwards, our intern. Robin Copley's back, our technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.